Hello, everyone. This is David Green, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center. Well, I guess we knew this might be coming. When you're running for president while facing 91 felony counts, including charges of defrauding the United States and obstructing a presidential election from being certified, a court somewhere might bar you from running for president again. And now we have the Colorado Supreme Court ruling by 4-3 to keep Donald Trump's name off the state's ballot in 2024. In a lawsuit that was filed by voters in Colorado, the court ruled that according to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, Trump is disqualified. The 14th Amendment, we should say, states that no one who previously held an office of the United States and took an oath to support the Constitution may hold an office of the United States if they engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. This amendment, which was ratified in the years after the Civil War, also states that anyone designated as disqualified by this amendment could be ruled eligible by a two-thirds vote in both the House and the Senate. Nothing is ever uncomplicated, right? So this decision, it applies just to Colorado, but the state court did stay their decision to give the U.S. Supreme Court a chance to weigh in. And now that leaves the door open for the Supreme Court to rule in a way that could be much broader. It could impact other states and really set the tone for this coming election year. A lot to talk about. Moa Lathy's here. Sarah Isger's here. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hey.
Sarah, is this really a setback for Donald Trump? It doesn't feel like one.
No. Politically, of course, I think it helps him. Nikki Haley was picking up momentum in New Hampshire. Chances are this is going to pretty much stop that in its tracks, right? Because Republicans feel like Democrats are saying they can't beat Donald Trump at the ballot box, so they don't even want him on the ballot at all in blue states like Colorado. You know, yes, all seven justices on the Colorado Supreme Court were appointed by Democrats, but don't forget this decision was 4-3. It was actually very close. Also worth noting that there's three other courts who have considered this before Colorado did. You didn't hear much about those decisions because, of course, those courts actually held that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, did not bar anyone from the ballot at this point.
Mo, I there's so many things I want to ask both of you, but let's start with the politics here. I mean, this does just help Trump, right?
In a Republican primary, yes. One of the most interesting dynamics throughout this entire Republican primary season has been every time Donald Trump finds himself in some sort of legal hot water, all of his opponents jump to his defense.
Yeah,
that's not something
we saw that again here. Yeah,
typically happens in a traditional race, but of course this is a non-traditional race, and you know in the Republican primary, I don't think this hurts him, and probably as Sarah said, helps him. Does it help in a general election? Well, look, if you know, I guess a lot of it depends on whether or not his name is on the ballot. But
that's an important thing to consider.
The problem, I think, and I say this as a Democrat, as someone on the left who believes very strongly that Donald Trump should never be allowed near the Oval Office again. Keeping his name off the ballot, denying him the right to run for president, even if it is the right thing to do legally, which some people think it is, it's just not going to help politically. I think the only way to defeat Donald Trump is to defeat Donald Trump. It is to beat him in an election, to make him a two-time loser. Then and only then do I think his grip on the Republican Party might start to lessen. Others will likely step into that void. But the narrative that is coming out of Colorado, I believe on the right, at least that I am seeing on the right, and this is to Sarah's point, it just reinforces the distrust in the institutions that many of his supporters feel, particularly the courts, and animates them in a way. The energy that it creates on their side could lead to higher turnout, could lead to helping him get more votes. My message to people on the left is whatever energy you are putting into celebrating this court decision, it's misplaced energy. That energy, stop celebrating and start mobilizing. That energy needs to go into defeating him at the ballot box, because that's the only way to stop him.
You know, even the special counsel Jack Smith, in his January 6th case against Trump, decided not to deliberately charge him with inciting an insurrection. So that's interesting. And then you have a court saying that because he took part or supported an insurrection, he's not qualified, you know, to run for president. That said, like, these four judges in Colorado, you know, and they said that they felt a solemn duty here. They felt how the weight of this decision. They said that they needed to follow the law and that they weren't going to make a decision based on what impact it might have on public opinion. I mean, if they, those four, decided that he either incited or supported people who did incite an insurrection, how could they not rule this way? Like, once they make that determination.
Oh, David, you've asked me to actually opine on the legal standards in this case. But I am going to ignore your question at first and make a political point to Mo's point, which is, look, I think that things that don't matter for Donald Trump politically or help him politically are when you didn't learn any new information, but elites or Democrats or someone tells you how to process that information. And this is like the quintessential example of that. We didn't learn anything new about Donald Trump's role on January 6th. It's just that these people are telling you that now that means it was an insurrection and that therefore he can't run for office again because it meets this very legal definition in the 14th Amendment. But they didn't learn anything. It was already baked into their thoughts about Donald Trump, what he did on January 6th. And right. I think that's an important part of the political discussion and that we've seen over and over again. If you're not learning anything new and it's just people telling you how to think about it, yeah, the Republican primary voters don't care what you think they should think or call something or words that you think have some import. So on the legal question, and I'll try to make this short and not boring.
Don't take us in the weeds. Don't take us in the weeds, Sarah.
Okay. So two things. One, could Colorado have done anything different? I think it's important to look at the three dissenters and what they were dissenting about. So there's two main things. One, they said that Colorado's state law did not allow this challenge to be brought the way that it was brought. There was basically an expediting state campaign statute that's like, hey, you don't have to actually like go through any of the normal process if, you know, this is just about who's going to appear on the ballot. So for instance, if someone's not 35 and you're like, they can't run for president, you don't really need the whole process, right? Just like, are they 35 or not? And the three dissenters are like, that is not what this state law was for, is to then have a 213-page opinion on the Brandenburg standards for incitement. And you basically denied this person due process by using the statute that wasn't meant for this. So that's one part of their dissent. That's a state law question, and the U.S. Supreme Court isn't going to get to touch that at all. State Supreme Courts get to decide state law. But the second part of the dissent is going to be really, really relevant when we get to the Supreme Court. And that is this section of the 14th Amendment, quote unquote, self-executing? Meaning, who gets to decide what evidentiary standards are at play here? Like, is it that we think he incited an insurrection beyond a reasonable doubt by clear and convincing evidence, by a preponderance of the evidence, just more likely than not? It's not written into the section here. So does every state get to decide for itself what the standard is? Or should Congress have had to do that themselves? Should they have had to pass a statute that says, hey, here's how you're going to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And here's the kicker. Congress kind of already did that. So there's a federal statute that specifically criminalizes insurrection and requires that anyone convicted of engaging in such conduct be fined or imprisoned and be disqualified from holding public office.
But Trump has not been convicted of that.
He hasn't even been charged with that.
Okay, so the Supreme Court, once it gets there, they could say, like, sure, if Donald Trump was convicted of inciting an insurrection, then the 14th Amendment might apply. But
definitely applies.
But it definitely applies, but it doesn't apply here. Because this actually, I'm glad you brought that up, how this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. This goes to a point that we've talked about before. I mean, trust in institutions saving our democracy. I, as much as I have a lot of problems with this court and its current makeup, and I disagree with a lot of decisions, I still have trust in the institution of the U.S. Supreme Court. And when you have such, as you said, Mo, a non-traditional election where you have someone who is charged with this many crimes and played some sort of role in one of the most horrible days in our nation's history, the decision as to whether he should be running for office, I want that in the U.S. Supreme Court. How many friends do we both have who are following this, you know, sort of casually and ask us all the time, like, so is Trump allowed to run? Should he be running? Isn't he convicted of all this stuff? Like, the U.S. Supreme Court should decide this at some point before everyone goes to the polls in 2024, period.
Yeah, and you know, the way this is going to play out is very predictable. Everyone, you know, a lot of Trump supporters, a lot of voters on the right who are up in arms and frustrated with the Colorado ruling are going to celebrate if the Supreme Court rules that Trump's name can and should appear on the ballot. Everyone on the left, all the activists on the left who are celebrating the Colorado ruling, are then suddenly going to attack the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court rules that way. And so this whole episode is just going to further erode, I think, trust in that trust you're talking about by one side or another, which is just putting us into this spiral, which is another reason why I believe there are two things coming up in the next year that are going to matter. One is the criminal trial of Donald Trump, and the election of 2024 is important. The only way we're going to settle some of these rifts, the only way we're going to settle some of these problems is that way. That's not to say there isn't a role for the court on some of these issues. We saw the importance of the courts in the aftermath of the 2020 election when the Trump campaign brought ridiculous after ridiculous suit trying to stop the election or trying to overturn the election. And courts, many of them run by conservative judges, overwhelmingly ruled against him. So there is a space and an important role for courts to play in the electoral process. But what's underlining and underlying Trumpism isn't going to be solved in a courtroom. That's got to be something we settle as voters.
Well, in speaking to that, did Joe Biden err in coming out and saying definitively that he thinks that Trump supported an insurrection, if the message should be that Americans should decide all of this?
No, I think again, there's going to be a criminal trial. That's a legitimate, you know, legal matter. You know,
he's not charged with that, though.
You know, so
right, that criminal trial won't be on whether he incited an insurrection, what Joe Biden said. He's not charged with the thing that Joe Biden said he did, which is a crime.
But I think, look, it's an issue that a lot of people are talking about, that this has been dominating the conversation ever since January 6th. The president gave his opinion on that, but basically said, let the courts figure it out. I think the message should have been, we need to figure this out. You need to figure this out. Voters need to figure out not whether or not he was guilty of an insurrection, but whether or not he's a threat to democracy. That the president is very strong when he leans into that message. It is one of the motivating factors for his campaign and his supporters. He needs to continue to lean into that part of this message more and more. Let the courts do what they're going to do, but the final word's got to be made by us as voters.
Sarah, take us home.
I just want to talk big picture about the U.S. Supreme Court. This will be the biggest test of the Supreme Court since Bush v. Gore. And remember, Bush v. Gore was a 5-4 decision, decided who was going to be president. And it really did undermine faith in the institution of the Supreme Court as something, partisan instead of being above partisan politics. It is, in a way, the animating force behind Chief Justice John Roberts. He never said it in his confirmation hearings, but when he was talking about judicial minimalism, trying to build unanimity around opinions, just calling balls and strikes, and what he has done since he's been Chief Justice for the last 18 years has all been about avoiding a 5-4 decision on Bush v. Gore under his tenure. This is that moment for him now. I really expect the Supreme Court to speak with one voice on this. There's a couple ways they can do that. It can be a 9-0 opinion, for instance. But there's another way, which is simply to write a per curiam opinion, which means that it won't be signed by any justice and there won't be any noted dissents and we won't know what the vote was on this. But I expect here, this is where the Chief Justice still only has one vote, right? But there are these soft powers that really matter at this moment. And this is what Chief Justice Roberts has been working for his whole career at this point.
Okay, we're going to stop there. Mo and Sarah and I will be back after a break. We're going to talk about an abortion decision in the state of Texas when we come back with more Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green, your host. We have Mo Alethi here, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, and Sarah Isger, who's Senior Editor at The Dispatch. The Supreme Court, we're still talking about the Supreme Court, their ruling on Roe versus Wade opened the door for states to figure out abortion access on their own. That was one of the big impacts of that decision. But a recent case highlights the issues that women continue to face when there are strict limits on those rights. And the state of Texas is where we're going to turn now as part of our 50 states series in the following year. So this series is our way of trying to zoom in from state to state to see politics from the ground up, how it is impacting people's lives and what we can learn from stories that are closer to communities. And we want to bring you the story of Kate Cox. She's a 31-year-old mom of two from near Dallas, Texas. And she was trying to have a third child, but learned her fetus suffered from a potentially fatal genetic condition. She sought an emergency order to have an abortion. Cox decided to leave the state to seek an abortion. And for more on her story, we have Paul Weber here. He's an Austin, Texas-based reporter for the Associated Press, who's been covering the abortion issue in Texas for more than a decade now. And Paul, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Paul, let's start with what exactly is Texas law when it comes to abortion today?
Yeah, so after the Dobbs decision last year, Texas became one of more than a dozen states in the U.S. That banned abortions at most stages of pregnancy. You know, abortion is outlawed in the state under most circumstances. There's no exceptions for rape or incest, as some states with bans have. The exceptions in Texas allow a physician to perform an abortion when the mother's life is in danger. The exception does not include fatal fetal anomalies. But the issue, you know, which was sort of the spotlight in Kate Cox's case, as well as some other women who have sued since the abortion ban took effect in Texas, is that the medical exception part of the Texas law, they say, is not defined well enough. That they say that it's too vague and it has left physicians sort of paralyzed and afraid to perform an abortion, even though there's an exception in it, because under the Texas law, doctors who perform an abortion that wouldn't meet this exception, they could be criminally charged, they could face lawsuits. And so that's all this sort of, you know, culminated in Kate Cox's lawsuit, which was, you know, since the Dobbs decision, was the first time anywhere in the U.S., as far as anyone knows, where a woman has asked a court for permission to receive an immediate abortion.
So you said that fatal fetal anomalies specifically are not part of the exception under Texas law, but there's a lot of gray area here in terms of what medical emergency means. And there were some who said that the fatal fetal anomaly also, depending on how this pregnancy went, could have put Kate Cox in harm. That's really the question, the medical question that wasn't really determined definitively here.
That's the issue that they're sort of taking up right now, right? Is, you know, what is a medical exception? Is the Texas law too vaguely defined? And during those arguments, you know, we heard justices on that court, which, you know, there are nine Republican justices, you know, they ask questions about, you know, both to the state, you know, and to, you know, the attorneys for these women about, you know, okay, so when is, you know, when does this law, this medical exception come into effect? You know, in Kate Cox's case, you know, both the Texas Attorney General argued that, according to the arguments that they make, that, you know, Cox's physicians never, you know, really basically demonstrated that her life was in danger. And ultimately, in a very, you know, quick ruling from the Texas Supreme Court that stopped that lower judge's ruling, they agreed and said that, you know, the the evidence, as far as they were concerned in front of them, did not demonstrate that her life was in immediate danger and qualified for the exception.
And where is Kate Cox now, and did she have the procedure, and how is she doing?
So after the, as you said earlier, so a Texas judge originally authorized permission for her to obtain a median abortion. Later right. that day, the Texas Supreme Court put on a hold. Before this Texas Supreme Court, though, issued, you know, wasn't a final ruling, but it was a ruling based saying that she could not obtain the abortion, Kate Cox left the state, and she got she obtained the procedure somewhere else. We don't know where. She has not, Kate Cox has not spoken publicly, you know, since that happened. But, you know, according to her attorney, she did obtain the procedure before that ruling came down from the court. You know, her attorneys had said that, you know, since she became pregnant, she had gone to the emergency room four times, including one time when this case was being litigated, you know, in those couple days where this was going on in the court, she had gone to the emergency room again. And they basically said that they could not, she could no longer wait for a decision in the case and had to go get the procedure somewhere else.
And Paul, if you could step back a little bit, like I'm just curious, I'm sure you know, you cover this, you spent tons of time talking to Texans about their views on abortion. Like those who believe that Kate Cox should not have been able to have this procedure, despite the potentially fatal fetal anomaly, despite, you know, potential risks to, you know, to her. What do people tell you when they explain those views and why they hold them so dear?
You know, I think the views here are the same as, you know, abortion opponents anywhere in the country. You know, Kate Cox, you know, since Kate Cox's case, you know, was making headlines and going through the courts, it's not been an issue that Republican lawmakers in Texas who, you know, put these laws in effect, they haven't been eager to talk about them. But, you know, as far as, you know, abortion opponents who have backed these laws and helped draft them in Texas, they thought that this was a case where the law worked. You know, they thought that she did not demonstrate that, you know, her life, you know, even though these were severe pregnancy complications, I believe the Texas Supreme Court in their opinion said that, you know, even serious pregnancy complications, they said, do not arise to a case where it would meet that exception. And so, so backers of the law, they acknowledge, you know, the tragic circumstances that you know, Ms. Cox was under, but they feel that the law worked and as it was intended to in this scenario. And the state, the Texas Attorney General's office, which, you know, has defended this law in many different ways since it was passed, you know, did this, some of this took place even before Dobbs. They defended it as well.
All right. Paul Weber reports for the Associated Press in Austin, Texas. Paul, enjoy your holidays and really appreciate your help understanding what's happening here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for your time.
One thing that struck me, when I asked Paul about views about this case, I'm sure there are a lot of people who don't believe in abortion, who think that the decision that the state Supreme Court made to stay out of this for the moment was the right one. But I guess I was sort of curious at an even deeper level to remind us all why there are, you know, a lot of people in our country who think that even in a case where there is a potentially fatal anomaly here that Kate Cox should not have had an abortion.
Yeah, so I think it's smart to start with, like, the actual pro-life community's defense of laws like this, and then talk about why this law might be very flawed and why the Texas Supreme Court's decision kind of just punted the whole thing off their plate. So what the pro-life argument is, look, the second you start saying that a potentially fatal anomaly is means that, you know, you can have an abortion, you're devaluing that life that, you know, yeah, it's potentially fatal. About 10% of diagnoses of trisomy 18 survive, at least, you know, to the first year, for instance. Rick Santorum's daughter has this diagnosis, and I believe she's 15 years old. So we know that some people do survive with it. And then, it, you know, this is a slippery slope. Like, well, what if it's not potentially fatal, but it's, you know, a lifetime disability of some kind? What if it's not an intellectual disability? What if it's just a physical disability, et cetera, et cetera? And so they've drafted a law that doesn't take into account the quality of life of the baby at all, but instead is taking into account the health of the mother. So there's two things that the Texas law says that are exceptions to the ban on abortion. One is the life of the mother, but the second one is substantial impairment to a major bodily function. And that's really actually what this was about. Kay Cox was arguing that this was going to, a third C-section would carry risk to her future fertility, and she wanted to have another child after this one because she believed there was a high chance this child would not survive. And so what the Texas Supreme Court really said was, yeah, look, all we're saying is you need a doctor to tell you that in their best medical judgment, this would substantially impair a major bodily function. In what you filed to this court, you didn't say that to us. So we can't say that you meet the exception or that your doctor wouldn't face criminal punishment for this. But you don't need to come back to us. No women need to come, you know, say these magic words. Just, you know, that's the only standard in your best medical judgment. That's what the statute requires. So, like, it would be fine if you did that, but you didn't do that in this case. Now, look, I will take issue with this because I think they did do that. If you go and look at the filings, they said in their good faith belief that she met the statutory standards, and the statutory standard includes that language about medical judgment. So it would be sort of redundant for them to keep saying the same words over and over again. But regardless, like usual, the reporting on this has been really dramatic and clickbaity. And the real answer is it's not a particularly well-worded statute. There is that case pending before the Texas Supreme Court to actually define, like, what is a major bodily function? Does that include fertility? Because frankly, every pregnancy carries heightened risk to the mother's life. Every pregnancy carries heightened risk that it will hurt your fertility in the future versus not being pregnant at all. So does that mean there is no abortion ban in Texas? That's the question.
So it sounds like this case is unresolved. I mean, she decided she wanted and needed to have an abortion. She went elsewhere. And as we just heard, she had the procedure done. But we're going to see this question, what medical exception means, probably come up in future cases, because it's really important, I mean, to determine based on some of these very strict limits that we're seeing in states like Texas.
Yes, because either, you know, life of the mother or substantial impairment of a major bodily function, the courts or the Texas Medical Board will have to define what those actually are, and they're going to be really heightened, like death or heart, you know, will no longer function type stuff. Or they're going to have to say, look, that's up to doctors, in which case those exceptions swallow the rule. That's the mess that all of these pro-life statutes are now in.
Mo, let me bring you in here.
I listened to this conversation, and I understand why this has become such a potent, powerful political issue heading into this next election. Because you look at the ferocity with which, and I do think there was ferocity, with which state officials tried to stop her from having this procedure. And I hear, and I think a lot of people hear, a profound lack of any sort of compassion in the way they would talk about her, in the way they would talk about this situation. And you look at where state officials are with already some of the most restrictive laws in the country and where local officials want to take it. There are now 4 Texas counties that have passed ordinances instituting travel bans for abortion, where they would, if they could figure out a way to enforce it, would actually prohibit anyone from traveling roads in their counties for the express purpose of going to another county to get an abortion or going to another state or place to get an abortion. The extent and the lengths to which these officials will go, even in a case like this, where whatever the words were that they put on paper in a briefing, the woman spoke very compassionately about her need, about the medical risk it presented to her as well as the fetus and her ability to have future children. And instead, it gets caught up in political and legal, in a political and legal maelstrom which comes across as just heartless. I understand why so many people are up in arms. I understand why so many places, even in red states, women and are going to the ballot box to speak out against this, because it's heartbreaking to see. It's heartbreaking to see. And I think when I understand the importance of the law. I believe in the rule of law. But when you see her case being reduced to a legal conversation, I think it just does a disservice to the very real pain and suffering that a lot of women facing these types of problems face.
The pro-life movement also has to contend with this fact, David. Abortions in the United States have increased since these laws have been passed, since Dobbs. And so you have to decide if you're pro-life. Are you, you know, is your goal to ban abortion or to reduce the number of abortions and actually save lives? Because those are very different goals, it turns out. And so, yeah, the pro-life community might be winning the ban war, but that certainly, surely was never actually the goal of the pro-life movement. And so they're failing at the real goal, which was to reduce the number of abortions in the country. And so I think to Mo's point, they should really start asking themselves, why are we losing the thing we actually were trying to do with the bans? If the bans aren't working, what are we missing here? And I think Mo's right. There's an empathy gap. There's a reality gap. You know, I have talked publicly about an ectopic pregnancy that I had. That's where the egg implants not in the uterus. They are not savable. You can't move them. They can also be a death sentence for women if it ruptures. It will kill you. And there's this like thought, and everyone's like, yeah, ectopic pregnancies. We excluded those from all of our laws. I'm like, yes, but you know what? It's not like there's some on-off switch that they look in my uterus and see like someone waving and saying it's empty in here. They're using an ultrasound and making their best guess, and they aren't sure. And in the end, we actually still don't know whether my pregnancy was actually ectopic because I declined to have the surgery for the same reasons that Kate Cox was worried, right? They remove your fallopian tube. I wanted to get pregnant again, et cetera. And so this idea that medicine is black and white, that we have all the answers, and that this doesn't affect real people and their lives and their families and their hearts. Miscarriages are just hard. And this conversation, I agree with Mo. What the pro-life community seems to lack is the ability to talk about this in a way that can land in real people's lives and the experiences that they've already had.
Okay, well, you brought up the empathy gap, Sarah, and that's where we're going to go when we come back after a break. We're going to talk about empathy and how it's really missing in our society and culture today, and that's when we come back with more Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger is here. Moa Lathy is here. And there was a story that the three of us saw recently that I think I would say it really shook us up a lot, all of us. A middle school teacher in the state of Georgia was arrested after reports that he threatened a 13-year-old seventh grader with violence. She had told the teacher that the Israeli flag that was hanging in his classroom offended her. And the student, who is Muslim, says that she and two other students went to the teacher's classroom and asked why he was flying the flag, and that she found it offensive due to, quote, Israelis killing Palestinians. This teacher responded by yelling at the students, following them into the hallway, and then making several threats as he made his way back to his classroom, including threatening to behead the student. And, you know, when the three of us were on our text chain talking about this. First of all, it's horrifying. And I think we all pointed out that it's horrifying that this guy was even in a classroom, if he's someone who is going to do something like that to a student. But Mo, I think it was you, and you saw this in a way as a missed opportunity, like where this could have gone had this teacher decided to be a mature adult and someone who wanted to use a student's fears, concerns to open the door for a conversation that could have brought people together instead of led to his violent threats and being arrested. It's really sad.
It is really sad. And, you know, there are so many issues out there that divide us and that demonstrate many of the social, cultural, religious, economic, educational, what have you, rifts in society. Maybe none have been more pronounced recently than Israel-Gaza and the conflict happening there. And one of the things, your passions are high, and I get it. You know, according to the reporting, this teacher is Jewish, has family that lives in Israel, displayed the flag in his classroom to show support for them. And so I understand that. I understand why he would. But the reaction to hearing the other side and the other perspective is what was really sad and depressing to me, and a huge missed opportunity for a moment, maybe not of healing, but at least better understanding. What if he had invited that student in and sat her down and said, let's talk about that. Let me tell you why, what the flag means to me and what it means to my family and why I flag it, why I fly it. Now you tell me a little bit more why it offends you, and let's have a conversation about it where we can better understand each other. I tell my students all the time at Georgetown that if we take a moment to just understand other perspectives, maybe we would find common ground. Maybe we won't, and that's okay if we don't. Maybe we'd be better advocates for our own side, for our own arguments, rather than running out into the hall screaming that these students are anti-Semitic. Maybe he would make a more persuasive case to them about why it was okay for him to fly it. And I think about that often, whether we're talking about abortion, as we just did in the last segment. I'm very passionately pro-choice, but I recognize that there are people out there who are very passionately on the other side for religious reasons. Maybe if I heard them articulate those, I could make a different argument to them, not compromising my values, but I could make a different argument to them. And maybe we could actually detoxify some of the air around the conversation. I just think it is important, so important, especially on these most these issues that elicit the strongest feelings and passions in all of us. I think it's important to take that moment to understand the person we're talking to. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, I used to talk about this and say, now there are some exceptions. I don't need to sit down and understand a white supremacist. Well, there's a fascinating story about a black blues musician in the South, I think maybe Tennessee, I don't remember exactly, but who was playing one day when a white gentleman in the bar came up and started talking to him about that music. And as they sat down, the gentleman said, you know, you're the first black person I've ever had a drink with. And the musician was surprised and said, how is that the case? And he said, well, I'm a member of the KKK. Those two gentlemen developed a bond over music. And the musician went on to attend various KKK rallies, talking to the members. And he now has a collection of hoods that those members have given up because they just couldn't feel the hate once they'd actually met and talked to someone who was black. And so there is evidence out there that by just showing that kind of empathy, maybe we can have an impact.
Yeah, I love the phrase compromise your values, because you can be curious about someone else and ask questions about why they believe something and listen. That act alone does not mean you are compromising your values. You can still hold your values close and stay true to your values, even if you're trying to understand where someone is coming from and seek common ground. Sarah, how did you react to all this?
First, I think we don't know the full facts of the case, right? Like, these are sort of what we've seen in media reports, and obviously the teacher isn't talking now that he's been put under arrest. And so we'll see what the facts actually show. But I think the point is, it doesn't really matter, because in the end, he failed, right? He failed to persuade. He failed to have a productive conversation with the student, regardless of what was actually said or what happened. But I also think this can go the other way. So there was a court case from the Virginia Supreme Court, which is sending back a case for trial, in which a teacher was fired because he would not use a student's preferred pronoun. The student, decided to change their name and was wearing different clothing, et cetera, and asked the teacher, told the teacher the new situation. And the teacher said, look, I'm deeply religious. I'm happy to use your new name. And I don't want to stigmatize you in front of all the other students. So also, I'm now going to not use pronouns at all in the class. I'll call everyone just by their name. It was in a French class. You know, you like pick your French name. So like they weren't even their real names, actually. So that's what the teacher did. But the student kept going to the administration and saying that this was not an acceptable accommodation for them and really pushing the school to fire the teacher, which the school did. Now, the Virginia Supreme Court has said that that teacher has a case and that he can sue the school. But again, like, set all the legal stuff aside. What a failed moment for, frankly, that student to open up and listen to someone who is trying clearly to have that conversation and to say, like, look, I want to meet you halfway. You know, for me, I can't use these pronouns that, you know, it would violate my religion to speak that. But let me explain to you, like, why I think that. And for the student to really say, wow, okay, you know, can I meet halfway in this? Because what I think you hear a lot from the right say right now is that people aren't willing to accommodate their beliefs, even if they're willing to say nothing at all, that silence is no longer even acceptable. It has to be affirmative support for someone else's choices, decisions, or whatever that might you feel violate your beliefs or your religion. Can we just drop all that? You don't need my support. Accept my tolerance. And tolerance should actually be that value that we're looking for. And tolerance, by the way, gets misused so often. Tolerance is not accepting something you already agree with, right? Tolerance is when you accept something you disagree with. It's like free speech. We don't need free speech for the stuff you like. We need free speech for the stuff you don't like people saying. We need tolerance for the stuff you don't like other people's lives, beliefs, and systems. And that's what both of these examples are to me.
You know, as we were sharing these stories with one another over text, David, you shared with us the story of a guy wearing a MAGA hat, a Trump supporter, who showed up at a rally, a progressive rally, and started and was heckling the crowd. The crowd started heckling back, and someone reached over and tried to rip his MAGA hat off his head, which triggered something in a Muslim woman who was there, who recounted all the time someone tried to rip a hijab off of her head, and she made the crowd stop. And she ended up talking with the guy, and they became friends. And he said, you know, I'd never met a Muslim person before. My perceptions were the way they were stereotyped in the media and the way my friends talked about them. And it was that common experience that developed, that forged some sort of bond, some sort of relationship. In this particular case, I think they would even say a friendship. Between two people who do not and will not see eye to eye on anything, but they at least took a step closer to one another's humanity. And that seems just so important today.
Yeah, that was in a StoryCorps did that story in their One Small Step program. They consider having conversations like that as one small step towards some sort of progress. And yeah, it was the shared experience that I really think stood out to me there as well, Mo. And I think that so often there is something shared. Like, so often I think there can be a feeling of, I'm afraid of something. And if two people talk about what they're afraid of, you realize that you're both experiencing fear. And as humans, you could help each other, you know, digest this fear and confront it. Sometimes it's just no one is hearing me and no one is understanding why something is so important to me. And if you just are heard by someone that is also feeling like they're unheard, that can mean something. So, you know, I this climate in our country right now is really, really difficult for this to happen. But the more that we can, you know, bring it up like this and talk about it, I hope that we can, you know, in some small way, encourage other people to do it. Just, you know, maybe as you're sitting down for holiday meals and stuff, if you disagree with someone, spend that extra moment to be curious and ask why they reached a some sort of position that bothers you. Okay, we're going to have to stop there. And we're going to move to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, I'll start with you.
Well, it's the holiday season, and I don't know if this is a rant or a rave or just a PSA. I like candles because I'm a red-blooded American woman who's filled her house with candles. And so we sometimes have power outages, or I just like lighting them around Thanksgiving, for instance. And my husband the other day walked in and said, "Is that supposed to be like that?" And I ignored him because I was talking to someone else. And then very loudly he said, "Is that supposed to be like that?" And I looked over. And no, candles should not be burning 2 feet up into the air because they had burned down far enough to light the other things that I'd kept around the candle on fire. So here's my PSA. Don't panic in those situations. It's very important to slowly and calmly and from a safe distance pour water on that situation. Do not splash water on it because the wax will splash back at you. So yeah, burn your candles. Just have some fire safety, a good fire extinguisher, a fire blanket, because it turns out nobody means to burn their house down.
Don't let the wax splash back at you. I think that's a very good PSA. Mo, over to you.
So I'm taping this from down in Miami after a horrible, horrendous travel day with everything that could go wrong going wrong, from mechanical problems on the planes to having to switch planes to further delays to missed connections to lost luggage. And needless to say, there were a lot of people angry at the airport, a lot of people yelling at the staff at the airline and the airport. Now, I hate that. I hate when people yell at the staff, but tensions were high. My rave, though, is that in this holiday season, there is still room for people to show that they care. There was one wonderful woman at American Airlines who went above and beyond to help my family and I get to where we needed to go, to the point of even giving me a cell phone number while I was on one leg of my flight. She and I were texting, trying to figure out the next. She showed nothing but empathy and help and support at a time when staff was frustrated and passengers were frustrated. And so I just want to say to this woman, whose name I will not mention, but I just want to say to her, thank you. You made a very tough day this holiday season much, much easier for my entire family.
Wow, that is lovely. I hope you and your family have safe travels and don't have to go through stuff like that again. I am going to rave, and I know that a lot of people might have different views about this, but I'm going to rave about the film Love Actually that is turning 20 years old. I'm sorry. I remain a fan. It is very controversial today. It has gotten more controversial over the years. And I just, when you talk about overcoming the empathy gap, I have empathy for anyone who watches this film and feels like it is outdated, feels like there are stereotypes that offend some people. And I would sit down with anyone and talk about problems with this film, problematic character choices, but I love it. It is part of my holiday, and I am going to, as I do every year, sit down and watch Love Actually with people I love before the new year.
Hey, David, can I make a request for people to find us on Threads or on the website, kcrw.com/LRC?
/LRC, yeah.
I would love for listeners to tweet at us or whatever their holiday movie suggestions, because I have a 3.5-year-old and it's sort of our first season for this kind of thing. And Love Actually, he's probably not going to get much of that. But what are the movies that would be like good family holiday movies that I should be putting in his repertoire?
I love that. Tweet at us your holiday film recommendations. And also the other thing we would love if you would tweeted us is ideas for our 50 states series, because we really want to look at stories around the country that we might be missing that say something about our politics and our larger national conversation. So let us know if there are stories out there you see that we should cover.
Does anyone think like 90% of the tweets are just going to be telling us to like Die Hard is a Christmas movie? Yeah, we get it. It's a Christmas movie.
I'll have that conversation. It is. Don't you think? Do you agree with me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay,
but like, we're done.
Yeah.
Conversation's over. Like, the debate has been had, and Die Hard won.
All right, and that is all the time we have. Sarah Isger, Moa Lathy, thank you, as always. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. Wishing everyone listening a really happy holiday season. I'm David Green. We appreciate you joining us, and hope you tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.